From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's obviously fire season in Arizona. Crews there are struggling to contain a huge wildfire that's already burned hundreds of square miles of forest. But what about the Sierra? What can we expect from fire season here after all those months of rain and cool weather? Will fire risk be higher because the plants are booming? Or will it be lower because the vegetation isn't as dry? We're going to tackle that question today, along with others related to the wet winter and spring. For example, what impact will the snow melt have on reservoirs? And what effect has all that snow had on tourism in the mountains? But we start with fire. Starting our discussion is Ken Pimlott, who's Acting Director of CAL FIRE, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. They're the folks who, among other things, put out those wildfires. Ken, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, has fire season started yet in California? And if not, when will it start?
Fire season has started in California, in certain areas, particularly Southern California. And as you know, California is very diverse across the state from the Oregon border to Mexico. And obviously, we've had a significant amount of rainfall and snowpack in the Sierra and Northern California, which has delayed staffing stations and bringing us into the true burning conditions that we would normally be entering into this time of year. But we're already picking up fire activity in Southern California. And actually, this same date last year, we have 375 more fires this year than last year.
Already?
Yes. The acreage burned is about the same, but we're already starting to see the fire starts, particularly Central Coast, Southern California, where the fuels are a bit drier.
I see. So fire season has started, but I guess in practical terms, it hasn't really started in Northern California, including the Sierra.
That is correct. And as you said it well, we've got above normal snowpack runoff. We've just had, again, 2 to 3 inches of rain just this past weekend in many areas of Northern California. And that certainly has the fuels green at the mid to higher elevations and, again, has delayed. Certainly, we've delayed some staffing in those areas where we can. But we're also looking, if you look at the grass and the fields, even just driving along the freeways here in Northern California, you can see how tall and dry the grass is. So all it takes is 1 or 2 days of dry, windy weather, and it can certainly dry those flashy, lighter fuels down to where they'll burn.
If we go back a few weeks or even a couple of months, what was CAL FIRE expecting for the summer? Were you expecting an early start in Southern California and a later start in Northern California? Is that how things looked coming into the summer?
Early into the year, we were anticipating a normal year, and we were staffing and preparing budgets accordingly. As the spring progressed, we realized that we were continuing to see these storm systems set up and move into the off the coast and set up to provide the rain and snow that it did. So as the spring waned on, we realized we would probably be in a good position to delay because, again, the snowpack, which would normally have been melted in certain areas, was continuing to linger and accumulate.
Ken Pimlott, Acting Director of CAL FIRE. Also with us is Don Turcotte, who's a professor of geology at UC Davis. He studies the statistics of occurrence of natural hazards, including wildfires, but also earthquakes, landslides, and floods. Don, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what impact, as far as you can tell, has all this wet weather and cool weather that we've been having this winter and spring, what is that impact is that going to have in the likelihood and the intensity of wildfires?
Well, certainly it has delayed the wildfire season, but there are so many other factors that are important, probably dominant high winds later in the year, that at this point it's impossible to predict just how bad things will be.
Because you don't know what those winds will be like.
The winds seem to be so dominant for the very bad fires, and when the things really get out of control, that will be the dominant factor as we come into September, late August, September.
Presumably, when you got a lot of snow still on the ground, that is, by definition, an inhibiting factor when it comes to wildfires.
Moisture is always inhibiting, but California summers are so hot that, except in certain areas and conditions, much of that moisture will disappear rather quickly.
Now, once the snow has melted, you're still going to have vegetation that I would guess is greener and maybe even not as dry as usual. Does that inhibit wildfires?
They certainly will in places, but the seriousness is more in the populated areas, which are at lower elevation, and pretty a lot in Southern California, but certainly in the Berkeley Hills, San Rafael, other places, the Sierra foothills, and those are not going to be affected by the snow that hangs on particularly.
Now, the vegetation that right now is greener and not as dry as usual, I'm guessing that that is probably encouraging growth. Does that mean that once we get into later in the summer and even into the early fall, that the fire risk could actually be worse because there's more vegetation?
Well, certainly in local areas where grass, dry grass, presents a real problem in urban areas, keeping it cut is absolutely essential. So later cutting will absolutely be essential in many urban areas as we go through the summer.
Yes. Ken Pimlott, this huge fire going on in Arizona, anything that occurs to you that you've learned from that that is of note for Californians?
Well, and again, it's the same message that these kind of conditions can surface, that the entire southern half of the country obviously has been experiencing significant drought conditions, and that has dried fuels and is creating the conditions that they're under. California is subject to the same kinds of conditions as we've seen over the years, 2003, 2007. And so it's certainly no surprise to us. We prepare for that. That's what Cal Fire is staffed for. And that's what we prepare for. And it's very important. And Don hit the message clearly. It's property owners, homeowners need to be prepared for the kinds of events that are occurring in Arizona or anywhere when we have wildfire. And that's, again, what Cal Fire has the offense. We're prepared to respond and provide fire protection and suppression. But the homeowners need to prepare by preparing their homes through defensible space, clearances around their homes, hardening the structures through fire-resistive material. They need to prepare evacuation plans so that when a fire does occur, they're ready to leave and can go, and they're not having to decide what to take. And our key message is the ready, set, go for homeowners. Get ready, prepare yourself, get set, and then leave when the fire occurs.
Well, hopefully for most people that is not needed, but good advice for when it does happen, because it will happen to some people, no doubt. Don Turcotte, earlier Ken explained that the fire season is really up and running in Southern California. Is that because it was a drier winter and spring in Southern California?
Well, Southern California is always drier. So the jet stream, everything's determined where the jet stream goes. And this has been a very unusual climate spring, winter and spring, because the jet stream has stayed south, so the storm track has stayed south. And eventually it's going to go north, but it's very late this year. And this basically is associated with the problems in the central United States. The tornado outbreaks, the current heat wave is a very different pattern than usually for this time of year. Whether this is La Nina or not can be debated, but it certainly has been an unusual year and very devastating in terms of tornadoes.
When you think about all the time and money and brain power that's been dedicated to trying to predict the weather for as long as humans have been around, it seems surprising to me that we are still debating such fundamental questions as, was there a La Nina effect or not?
Well, that's all true, but I think there's, as one looks into global warming and climate change, it's very easy to blame everything on that and forget that it's a very complex system. It's chaotic, and there's tremendous statistical variability. And separating out the normal statistical variability from driven effects like climate change are extremely difficult and in some cases just simply impossible.
And you said earlier, Don, that the winds are a big factor when it comes to California wildfires. Isn't that more of a problem in Southern California than up here?
Well, one has to remember the Berkeley fires that were very devastating with large loss of life. And those cities have really instituted a lot of cutbacks, mandatory cutbacks to keep brush away, et cetera. And even then, though, I run into people who still want to preserve the beauty of having brush coming right up next to their house. And so there is a tremendous danger in the Berkeley Hills, San Rafael, the foothills here in the Sierra. It's just unfortunate, but it's true.
Ken Pimlott, with the budget cuts in the background for every State Department, how is that affecting Cal Fire, and should we be concerned?
Cal Fire is staffed and prepared. We'll be deploying fire resources just as we would every year.
But have you had to lay off people?
We have not had to lay folks off. We are staffing with 3 firefighters instead of 4 on the fire engines. We obviously, every department's, these are significant budget times. And as Don talked about, everybody's having to look at public safety across the board. But we mitigate that. We have the ability to order additional resources. The incident commander at the scene can order additional fire engines and hand crews. At the peak of fire season, all of our fire stations will be open and staffed like we would every year. Our aircraft will be readily available. CAL FIRE, along with all of the fire departments in California, are prepared to respond like we would every year.
Now, this is probably a whole nother topic, but I have to ask it. It seems likely that many state parks will close. Whether they're long-term or short-term closures, we don't know. But because of the budget cuts, in any case, what it means is there's going to be less staffing at these parks, but there could still be people going into the parks. All of that seems to me that it could raise fire risk. Does CAL FIRE have a position on the state park closures, assuming they happen?
CAL FIRE does not have a position directly on the closures. However, our units work directly with those state parks and the state park at the system at the state level to help mitigate those factors. If they identify risks from that, we work together to develop fire protection plans, et cetera, fire prevention patrols, et cetera, to address any additional risk that may come from that. And again, that occurs locally with the park superintendents and staff.
And finally, I was looking at the CAL FIRE website, and there's a chart of the 20 largest California wildland fires by acreage burned. And one thing that really stood out for me was that 11 of the 20 have happened since 2000, and another one happened in 1999. So that's 12 of these 20 fires, massive fires, happened in the last 12 years. Don Turcotte, is that a coincidence?
In my opinion, it's certainly not a coincidence, but one has to, you can blame it on climate change, but you also have the basic big problem of buildup of combustible materials. And it's clear that suppression of fires allows the buildup of material that's going to create these massive fires. In Baja California, they don't have massive fires because they don't put out the small fires. So there is this basically the society has induced a condition which leads to massive fires.
And in case people are wondering about that, the small fires burn up in a low-key way dry waste on the forest floor, and if that doesn't happen, then you create a tinderbox for bigger fires.
That's right. And the natural ecology of California is built on perversive fires, particularly during the summer season when they don't get so much out of control with the winds, and that's what happens in Baja, and it leads to a completely different ecology and a completely different risk situation.
But Ken Pimlott, I guess another factor is humans. A lot of these fires were caused by humans, and part of that must be the growth in population. There are more people going into wild areas and more people living near the wild areas.
Yeah, 94% of fires on the state responsibility area, the 31 million acres of private land that CAL FIRE protects, are started in some way related to people. And but those occur not only in the urbanized areas, but they occur from people driving through the rural areas, vehicle fires, other kinds of starts. And so, yes, people are a significant equation in this. But again, it doesn't just occur in the urbanized areas. We have fire starts that are occurring throughout the state responsibility area.
Well, thank you both so much. Ken Pimlott is Acting Director of CAL FIRE, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And Don Turcotte is Professor of Geology at UC Davis. He studies the statistics of occurrence of natural hazards, including wildfires, but also earthquakes, landslides, and floods. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, more on the impact of our long, wet winter and spring. We'll talk about how much water is still frozen in the mountains and what will happen when that snowpack starts to really melt. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation today, Rick Santorum joins the presidential race, Sarah Palin replays the midnight ride, John Edwards lands in court, and Congressman Anthony Weiner finally comes clean. It's this week's Political Junkie segment. Also, Henry Kissinger and Ted Koppel join us for a conversation about China. Talk of the Nation starts at 11, right after Insight. Now, more on the impact of our long, wet winter and spring. We're going to talk now about, earlier we heard what it means for wildfire risk. Now we'll talk about the snowpack. There's a lot of water still frozen in the mountains. What will happen once all that snow melts? We'll start our discussion with John Erickson, who's hydrology branch chief at the California Department of Water Resources. John, thanks for joining us today.
Jeffrey, you're welcome.
Well, the California Department of Water Resources wants to make sure everyone gets their water, but is also concerned about floods. How does that huge snowpack look to the people like you at Cal Water?
Jeffrey, it's absolutely a balancing act that we look at every day. The Sacramento River system is less influenced by the snowmelt runoff, but we do have concerns about the San Joaquin River Basin, so we're continuing to coordinate with our federal partners, the National Weather Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the local reservoir operators on a daily basis to make sure that they've prepared for that snowmelt runoff.
Is there reason to fear flooding in the summer or later?
Jeffrey, if we had an extended period of extremely warm temperatures, that volume of water that's contained in the snowpack could come off very quickly and be difficult to manage. Right now, we're running models every day and looking at hundreds of scenarios a day in terms of what's happened historically, given the volume of water that's in the hills right now. So right now, we feel comfortable that it's being managed appropriately. With the warmer weather also, there's an increase in demand. So that water right now is being put to good use for agriculture and water supply uses.
And when you say an extended period of warm temperatures, do you mean warmer than average for the time of year?
Yeah, what we're seeing right now in basically the five-day forecast is a return to essentially normal temperatures, what we expect this time of year. So what we'd be concerned with mainly is something that was maybe in the 90s or 100-degree temperature ranges that stayed for an extended period and also resulted in overnight temperatures above freezing for an extended period at the higher elevations.
One of the responsibilities of the California Department of Water Resources is measuring the water content of the Sierra snowpack. How does the snowpack look right now, and overall, how was it this winter?
This winter was, as you know, extremely heavy snowpack. Right now, currently, we have snow levels, snow water equivalents in the northern, central, and southern Sierras, essentially about where they would be typically on average April 1st of most years. So that snowpack has stayed for an extended period.
And do you know typically, well, maybe there is no typical, especially this year, but when would you expect all that snow to be melted?
We would have expected, and we've seen significant snow melt already. So most of the low elevation snow below 7,000 feet has come off already. Our concern is the deeper snowpacks above 7,000 feet. That's a big concern, again, in the San Joaquin River Basin, where elevations rise to over 14,000 feet. So it's going to be when those overnight temperatures tend to increase above freezing at night so that water doesn't have a chance to melt and then refreeze, and that kind of slows the melt. So we'll be keeping an eye on that every day.
And there was just snow last weekend in the Sierra.
Yes, there was. That wasn't a significant accumulation, but those cooler temperatures again continue to delay the majority of the snowmelt that we're expecting.
I read the other day that there was an expectation that the snowmelt would peak in early August. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
No, our projections, we work closely with the National Weather Service, have many different tools that we look at, but we're right now projecting towards the end of June to see the peak snowmelt runoff from the snowpack.
John Erickson of the California Department of Water Resources. We're talking about the snowpack in the Sierra and the melting of that snow. Also with us is Peter Lucero, who's Public Affairs Officer with the Bureau of Reclamation's Mid-Pacific Region. The Bureau is part of the U.S. Department of the Interior and manages water in the western United States. Pete, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
When I look at the state of the reservoirs in California, it looks like they're close to full.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, today, for example, we are at about, on average, about 15% above what would normally be this time of year in all of our reservoirs. So we're looking, our reservoirs are very healthy. That being said, we are also, you know, we work hand in hand with John and his crew to assure that we're helping to create this balance of a full reservoir or maximizing our storage at the same time as maximizing downstream flood protection. So it's a very difficult balance, but yes, in fact, we are, with the exception of one reservoir, Millerton Reservoir on the San Joaquin system that John was talking about, that is a relatively low at about half capacity because we know that the water coming from that system will come fast and we'll need to capture it fast.
You said that, but the, generally speaking, though, the reservoirs are about 50% above where they would normally be at this time of year. Is that a good thing or not, or is it neutral?
It's a good thing for water storage. I think for California and the water users, it's a very good thing to have that kind of water in there. Now, if we can have as John was talking about, if we can have a measured runoff event this year, we will sustain those high levels into the next year and come out of this year in 2011 with good carryover storage into 2012. And we always look forward to that.
Now, you said if we can have a measured runoff season, but that depends on factors that we have no control over.
That is exactly right. And, you know, we're hoping that Mother Nature will cooperate with us and allow us to balance that those releases with the inflows on a consistent level that maximizes both of our goals here.
So if a heat wave were to start in the next couple of days, an extended heat wave, does that mean you'd have to start opening the gates at the reservoirs and let more water out than you'd planned?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, right now on the American River system at Folsom, we have done that, and actually on Shasta as well. We ramped up over the weekend to about 20,000 CFS at Shasta from about 9,000.
That's cubic feet per second.
That's cubic feet per second, thank you. And that was actually because we were going to get a lot of rain in the Shasta area. We wanted to make sure we were able to capture that rain and provide the flood protection necessary. So we had to make room in the reservoir for that. And we're currently doing that now at Folsom, where we've increased our releases from about 7,000 cubic feet per second to 9,000. And we hope to hold it about 9,000 for the time being.
Yes. John Erickson at the California Department of Water Resources, what about water allocation? The state updates how much water it expects to give its customers throughout the winter. Where are we now?
Jeffrey, I'll have to defer on that one. I'm not an expert on the allocation methodologies. I can tell you that in many instances, it's a factor of the infrastructure. It's actually conveying that water around that causes some of the difficulties in terms of providing full allocations.
I see. So in other words, there could be a whole bunch of snow and ice and water, but the system might not be able to hold it and store it and transfer it in the way we might want.
Right. The population demographics are opposite of where the rainfall falls and where it's needed in many instances within California. So a lot of that water has to be moved throughout the state, and that's where the difficulty lies.
Yeah, I did check the California Department of Water Resources website earlier this morning, and the most recent press release I could see about water allocation was on April 20th, which said that the allocation had been increased to 80%. Which I guess surprised me a little bit, because when you think about all the water and the rain and snow that's fallen, raising to 80% still seems obviously below 100%. But John, I understand you can't comment on that, perhaps.
Yeah, it is difficult oftentimes to explain, but there's many limitations to moving the water throughout California. The pumping restrictions due to the Endangered Species Act in the Delta, et cetera, just in terms of the capacity of the conveyance, also causes limitations as far as how much water can be moved throughout the state.
Yes. That's John Erickson at the California Department of Water Resources. Pete Lucero, since you're on the phone with us, just about a week or so ago, I was on the American River bike trail just downstream of Folsom Dam and saw the latest of all this massive work that's being done in this spillway. It looks like it's at an advanced stage. Is that right? And could you just tell people what that spillway is for and what impact it will have?
Absolutely. That's an auxiliary spillway. It's called a joint federal project where we and the Corps of Engineers and other agencies have partnered to provide greater level of protection for downstream of Folsom Dam. That auxiliary spillway is going to be about a 3,000-foot chute, essentially, that will divert water or allow us to release water at a lower level in the reservoir to capture any floodwaters that come in from the Folsom watershed, the American River watershed. One of the things I think is key here is that the Folsom Dam, of course, the gates at the top are at a very high level in the reservoir, so we have to have a lot of water in the reservoir to start releasing water. In the event of large flood events, as you know and you've seen in the past, that's waiting perhaps too long to empty the reservoir, and it's a very small reservoir. So the idea is to install gates at a lower level within the reservoir so that we can start making those releases sooner to allow those inflows to come in and provide that greater level of protection for the downstream community.
It looks like a lot of the spillway work has been done. Let's just say that there were a huge snow melt in the next few weeks and you needed to release water in a hurry. Would you be able to make use of that work now, or do you have to stay with the current system?
No, we have to stay within the current system because the actual gates are not in yet. We've done the excavation of the chute, and then we've got a big, what I would call a plug there at this point, the groundwork that's still there. That plug is there so that we can actually build on the other side, on the dam side or the lake side of the plug, the actual concrete facility. So it will be several years before that's complete. We're looking at a couple, three more years before we actually have it complete and operational.
So in the meantime, I guess we'll just cross our fingers.
We operate as we've operated for many years at Folsom. That's correct.
That's Pete Lucero. He's Public Affairs Officer with the Bureau of Reclamation's Mid-Pacific Region. Also joining us for the segment was John Erickson, Hydrology Branch Chief at the California Department of Water Resources. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, more on the impact of our long winter and wet spring. What has all that snow done for tourism in the mountains? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, actor Colin Hanks, son of Tom Hanks and a Sacramento native, he's raising money for a documentary about the late lamented Tower Records. And on this week's Sound Advice, some of the eclectic music donated to our annual used record sale. You'll hear traditional music from Tibet, a song from The Police, and more. That's Insight tomorrow. Today, we're focusing on the impact of our long, wet winter and spring. Earlier, we heard about the water still frozen in the mountains and what will happen once all that snow has melted. Now, we'll wrap up our coverage by hearing what all that snow has done for tourism in the mountains. With us is Andy Chapman, Director of Tourism at the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Well, snow is, in principle, a good thing for resorts in Tahoe. Do you get to a point where there's too much, though?
Well, when it was still snowing on June 1st, it was, I think, in my mind, time to be over. But it certainly was a fantastic year and kind of a record-breaking snowfall for us this year.
What impact did all that snow have on the skiing?
It was big. You know, we had an excellent ski season. I think one of our resorts, Squaw Valley USA, hit the all-time record about a week or so ago with over 800 annual inch snowfall. So it was big, a lot of great powder days, and a lot of good business this last winter.
Well, sure, there's a lot of snow and fresh snow for people to ski on and snowboard on, but there were so many storms. Did that also make it harder for people to get up to Tahoe?
Sure. There were certainly some storm impacts. You know, whenever the storms come rolling in, we do get some impacts on the roads with some closures and things like that. You know, high-level lifts may be shut down due to wind operations and things like that. But, you know, the Caltrans and Placer County Public Works know how to clear the road off the snow off these roads and did a fine job on that. But you do definitely have some impacts when these storms come in.
Yeah. But it seems to me that there are a lot of people who like skiing and snowboarding, but they associate it only with a certain period of time. And even if the snow is great in, I don't know, April or May, they just don't go up there and do that. Is that right? Have you noticed that phenomenon?
Yeah, you certainly see that. I think that the key is really what happens from a weather perspective in our core target market. So if it stays kind of dreary and and snowy and or rainy in the Bay Area and Sacramento, that tends to keep people's focus on winter sports. Once it starts warming up in the late April, mid to late April time frame, certainly golf clubs come out, bikes come out, and that starts changing people's behaviors.
Yeah. My guest is Andy Chapman. He's director of tourism at the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. Are people still skiing at the resorts?
Yeah, the Squaw Valley shut down on Monday of Memorial Day weekend, so they went all the way through that point. They are planning, a couple of our resorts are planning to open back up over the July 4th period.
Really?
Because we'll still have, there's still so much snow up in the mountains. I mean, we've had a huge amount of runoff already, and basically out my window of my office watching the lake rise probably over 4 feet. But there's still, it's still going to come up another foot. But half is what I'm understanding. So there's a lot of snow in upper elevation still.
So you have a lake view from your office window?
You know, it's not too bad, yes. It's not too bad.
When is transition time usually for the Tahoe resorts? When do they usually expect to be into the summer season?
You know, that transition will happen during the month of June, typically. We get through the Memorial Day weekend, and Memorial Day weekend for us can still be a winter holiday travel period, or it could be a more of a summer period, but it's not really the major kickoff. That happens as we kind of get through June, and certainly by July 4th, we're fully into our summer operations. It is now projected to be some pretty nice weather, finally. We're happy to see the sun up here, so we're going to start seeing some of that summer activity really kicking in now.
So, but with all that snow still on the ground and a lot of people just not into skiing or snowboarding at this point, is that having a negative effect on businesses?
No, I don't think so. I think what we will see is some of the upper elevation hiking trails and maybe mountain biking trails are going to be inaccessible for another couple months maybe. But that'll make for some great late season riding up there. The lower elevation, the snow's burned off around the lake. All of the lake access points and boat launches are up and operating. So it's really just anywhere up above kind of that, 7,500 to 8,000 foot elevation and above.
But above 7,500 feet, you're saying that it could be at least a couple of months before bike and hiking trails and so on are clear.
Well, certainly at the upper elevation, when you hit that, 8,500, 9,000 foot elevation, some of our top peaks are just under the 10,000 up here. The lower elevations will burn off and have burned off, and the rest of it will slowly come in. But it's going to be another 30 days before some of those access points are going to open up.
So I guess High Camp at Squaw Valley is going to be under snow for quite some time.
Yeah, the good thing there, obviously, is they have the facility that allows them to go up on the tram, which is how you get up there, and they have the swimming lagoons already opened up. The ice skating rink will still stay open. Facilities like at North Star and their mountain biking park, they will open up their lower elevation areas first and then slowly move the parks and the features up the hill as the snow melts.
And finally, Andy Chapman, the Tour of California bicycle race this year moved up into the mountains, well up into the mountains. And stage one was going to be 1.5 route circuits around Lake Tahoe. Stage two was going to start at Squaw Valley and head up to Truckee. But stage one, as most people know, was canceled because of bad weather. And stage two was moved from Squaw Valley to Nevada City, if I remember correctly. That must have been a disappointment for the people in Tahoe.
Oh, yeah, it was a huge disappointment. It had been a lot of couple years' worth of work to bring that event up here. However, I think this community really recognizes the positives that came out of that. I mean, we had everything ready to go for that race, and unfortunately, that little piece of Mother Nature that we can't control. And certainly, we supported and understood the decisions and agreed with them because safety of the riders, safety of spectators, and safety of crew was really the most important aspect. And it was a fluke storm. I mean, I think it snowed on Mount Hamilton for the first time in 25 years in May at that point as well.
Yeah, so Tahoe didn't get the beautiful TV coverage on Versus that covers a tour of California, but I guess you probably still got quite a lot of hotel nights because all the crews and so on were there anyway.
Yeah, people were here. The teams really showed up on Sunday and Monday the week prior. They had beautiful training weather. They saw the potential of the opportunities. you know, and we're currently continuing our discussions with the tour organizers and what next year may look like.
So you're working on bringing it back to Tahoe next year and hopefully having an actual race?
Yeah, we're going to, as I like to say, take another swing at that bat. So.
Okay, well, Andy Chapman, enjoy the view from your office window. It's better than most of ours, and good luck to everyone in the Tahoe region.
Great. Thanks, Jeffrey. Have a great day.
That's Andy Chapman, Director of Tourism at the North Lake Tahoe Resort Association. And that wraps up our coverage for today of the impacts of the long, wet winter and spring. When we come back, we'll catch up with Kevin Riggs, until recently a political reporter on Sacramento TV and one of the city's most respected political journalists. He now works as a political consultant. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Capital Public Radio News today, farmers and environmentalists team up in the Merced area to try to save a type of blackbird that used to thrive in the Central Valley. That story and more on All Things Considered starting at 4. One of Sacramento's best-known and most respected reporters stepped down a couple of weeks ago. For 17 years, Kevin Riggs covered politics and anchored the news at KCRA Channel 3. Now he works in political media consulting and analysis for the Sacramento public relations company Randall Communications. He's in our studio. Kevin Riggs, welcome back to Insight.
Jeffrey, it's good to see you. I think the last time you and I were together face-to-face was the debate at UC Davis last fall.
The gubernatorial candidates
right.
debate. Yes, a
right.
successful event that was, too. Well, as you know, and maybe you did it yourself, when someone ceases to be a reporter and goes into the PR business, they say, reporters say, you've gone to the other side. Did you see yourself going to the other side?
We all joke about it being the dark side.
Yeah.
For a long time, I never thought of myself as going into that arena, but I just had a... I'd been thinking about making changes for a while, and this seemed like a good opportunity to do it. Now, we were talking my last week on the job at KCRA. When the news about Arnold's Love Child came out, I almost rethought my decision to leave the business. Almost rethought it.
That's a great story, isn't it? And in more serious political matters, it was also the May revise for the governor's budget, and the budget has never been probably a bigger story than now.
That's right. The May revise was on Monday of that week, and that was a huge issue. And then on Wednesday of that week, I had talked to the former speaker, Fabian Nunez, about that hugely controversial decision by the governor to shorten the sentence of his son in that murder case. So it was a very busy week. It was a good week for me, a good thing for me to leave on. Let's put it that way.
Well, you said that you'd been thinking for some time about making a career change. Specifically, though, what happened? What led you to decide to go work in political communications?
Well, this is not a job that I believe you can do forever. Jerry Brown was nice enough to attend a going-away reception for me a few weeks ago that was put on by the Correspondents Association and the Press Club. And I told him, I said, you know, you were governor when I first started in TV news, and now that it's come full circle and you're governor again, what really is left? You know, he kind of laughed. But it's true. I've always loved the business. I'll always miss TV news because what a great career. I mean, I got to travel the country. I got to travel the world in some cases, really have a front seat perch on history. But I just had a strong feeling, Jeffrey, that this was a good time for me to go out on my own terms and try and use my communication skills in a different sort of way. Not an easy decision, but I just felt it was the right time.
Was there anything about the nature, the changing nature of the TV news business?
Yeah, as you know, journalism continues to struggle to connect with as many news consumers as possible, whether it be radio, print, television, and there's been a real shift of resources and effort to the web. In the case of Channel 3, that has meant relatively recent multiple web publishing deadlines. A lot of web publishing deadlines. Of course, you have to do the new media, the tweeting, the posting of video and pictures, online streaming. All of that has led to even more juggling of deadlines and responsibilities. And in my opinion, it made it much more difficult for me to do the kind of quality broadcast work I'd done in the past.
Was KCRA still committed to you being a political reporter, or was there a move to hand you an all-weather jacket and send you up to Blue Canyon?
Well, I did spend a little more time at Blue Canyon than I had in the past. I think there was a commitment to covering politics because that was my expertise, and that's certainly what I brought to the station. But the reality of a slimmed-down staff was that more often than in the past, I got diverted from Capitol coverage to cover other things. I don't think that was a reflection of a lack of interest in political coverage, but more a logistical thing. Fewer reporters to cover X number of stories, and so I ended up doing that kind of thing. It did make it more difficult for me to have the more consistent presence at the Capitol that I think you need to be an effective political reporter, and that was just something that was sort of the new reality.
My guest is Kevin Riggs, former political reporter and news anchor at Channel 3. He recently left KCRA and now works for Randall Communications. If you go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight, you'll see some archive photographs of Kevin Riggs. And there's also a link to a video package made by KCRA that was a tribute to Kevin's long career in TV news. Kevin, the picture we're highlighting is one of you with Ronald Reagan, and you have the almost obligatory news anchor mustache.
Yeah, I was joking in that farewell clip that it was sort of the Ron Burgundy look of the 1980s. You know, you had the wide lapels and the mustache and the bushy hair. I was very fortunate to cover Reagan as a young reporter relatively recently out of college because my first TV job was in Santa Barbara. Boy, when you start in Santa Barbara, you know it's all downhill from there. But he used to, as you know, he would come out and spend a tremendous amount of time at the ranch. And when he did, of course, the White House press would come out. They'd set up in a beachfront hotel. They'd have daily White House briefings. And I got to witness all of that and take part in all that firsthand. So that really sparked my interest to a large degree in political coverage. Reagan would have these summer press parties, sometimes in the Hope Ranch area of Santa Barbara, sometimes at a horse ranch up in the San Ynez Valley, and they would invite local press as well as White House press. And it was always very choreographed. You'd see the Marine One helicopter flying overhead, and you'd say, okay, he's on his way. And then he would come down, and he would mingle with everybody. The White House photographer took the picture that you're referencing there, and we all got a chance to chat with him a little bit. So it was... It was a heady experience, especially for a young reporter.
And it's such a classic image of Ronald Reagan because he's got his cowboy hat on and the cowboy shirt.
Yeah, that's when he was at the ranch, he didn't make a lot of news. It was always funny. His press secretary, Larry Speaks, would come out and he'd say, okay, he'd talk about the stuff in Washington and he'd say, now, the ranch report. And everybody would sort of groan in the room and he'd say, the president chopped some brush today, cleared some brush, and then went horseback riding. But he enjoyed that sort of Western lifestyle, and that's what he did on the ranch.
So you started out at KCOY in Santa Barbara, and then you moved to KFSN in Fresno, bigger market?
Right. And people said, are you crazy? You left Santa Barbara and you went to Fresno. But it was a bigger market, an opportunity to kind of move up the ladder a little bit. And there I continued to cover more Capitol stories. I actually would come up to Sacramento quite often from Fresno. We had some leadership in the state capitol from Fresno. Ken Matty, the Republican leader, was one. And so I got to spend a lot more time up here after moving to Fresno.
Yeah. And then you moved to KCRA, where you worked for 17 years.
Right.
Sacramento is a big TV market. It's a top 20 TV market. But a lot of people move on, make one more step up to the biggest markets. Did you think, oh, I like it here, or did you entertain thoughts of moving to L.A., San Francisco, whatever?
Well, most people don't know this, but I actually had an opportunity to go to Los Angeles to one of the O&O's, owned and operated network stations, at the time that I made the move to Sacramento. And I just, at the time, I knew my own thinking. My interest was in covering politics, and I knew that if I wanted to do that, Sacramento was a good place to do it, obviously. So that entered into my thinking in coming to Sacramento. Coming here, I was thrilled because KCRA had a national reputation for its news coverage.
It was a family-owned station.
It was a family-owned station at the time. It was owned by the Kellys. They had a huge budget. We traveled extensively. They spent a lot of money to have reporters go all over and cover things. So it was a great place to be, and I frankly thought, after being there a few years, I started off as a general assignment. I moved into full-time political reporting. And I thought the only place that I would be interested in moving to from KCRA would be to Washington, D.C. to continue the political coverage. And I had young children at the time, and I just made the decision that I liked Sacramento.
It seemed to me, especially in the past, that with the Kelly family's commitment to funding in-depth coverage and having a big news department and the state government coverage, that KCRA seemed like a bigger market station than it really was.
It's true, and I think part of that was the Kellys did part of this almost as a prestige thing. They liked to be able to say they ran this huge operation, and it was a privately held, family-owned station, as you said, and so they didn't have to answer to a board of directors or stockholders, and they pretty much could spend what they wanted to spend. And so I wouldn't say that the sky was the limit, but there was a much more open checkbook policy then than later when we were owned by corporate.
And when I watched that montage at KCRA put together of your career, it included, from not that long ago, a trip you made to Jerusalem when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor. So it wasn't that long ago when such a high-budget trip was being made.
Right. And they had to scrape together the money to come up with that one because that was a high-dollar trip. But it was, we felt it was important because it was Schwarzenegger's first overseas trip as governor. Also, the interesting kind of hook for us was his father had been a member of the Nazi Party in Austria as a policeman, and he was going to Jerusalem to do a groundbreaking for a museum of tolerance.
Oh, that's
right.
So
the irony was thick, and so we wanted to go over there and hear what people had to say about that. Plus, he was also transforming at that point from action movie hero to the political stage, and we thought it'd be interesting to go and choreograph, witness that sort of thing.
So now moving to your current occupation, what exactly will you be doing or are you doing?
Well, I decided to make the move to Randall Communications because I felt strongly that the company has integrity. I've known Jeff Randall and Mitch Zack, the two principals, for a long time. They've been involved in the political arena for years here in the Sacramento area. And like any good reporter, I checked out the firm and found that they had a good reputation for integrity and service. And so that made me comfortable in terms of the decision to go. As far as what I'm doing, they've given me a title of senior vice president, which sounds very grandiose. But but essentially, a lot of what I'm going to be doing is media training and media advice. We tend to think in the media business that most people understand how it works. They understand the interview process. They understand the news cycle. And a lot of people, in fact, most people do not.
Yeah.
So there's a big market for that kind of training. I'm going to be doing a lot of that for both corporate and political clients. They're going to want me to provide some strategic advice to different types of clients. And as you mentioned, I'm still going to be on the air at KCRA3 providing analysis from time to time.
So when there's maybe an election going on and they have various experts, and you will be one of those experts.
I'll be one of those experts. I'll be talking about that. I presume I'll be talking about budgetary issues. It's almost like skimming the cream, you know.
Yes.
I'm not the guy staking out the governor's office anymore for hours on end, but I get to go on the air and talk about it.
But it might be a little funny that first time you step in there as an analyst as opposed to a reporter.
It's a little different. Yeah, it's a different hat. And I'm not going in there as a partisan analyst. You know, we have those. I'm in there strictly to explain what's going on.
Yes. Kevin Riggs, former political reporter and news anchor at Channel 3, now a senior vice president at Randall Communications. Kevin Riggs, thanks again so much for joining us.
Enjoyed it.
And again, you can see some old pictures of Kevin Riggs as a reporter on TV at our webpage, capradio.org/insight, as well as that link to that montage of his career. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll be back tomorrow. Today's associate producers, Sosin Marar, Lynn Weaver, and Liz Cazares. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer taking it very easy today is Jen Picard. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
It's good to be here in the culture bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
It's kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.